Connect and experience art at the Northfield Arts Guild. Visit our galleries, arts festival, and take in a performance at our theater featuring a full season of dramas, comedies, and musicals. The Guild's gift shop showcases unique art from over 100 local and regional member artists. Come enjoy music from the Cannon Valley Regional Orchestra or the 411 Concert Series. We invite you to explore your creativity in one of our classes. All are welcome at the Northfield Arts Guild. To learn how you can be a part, visit northfieldartsguild.org. Or call 507-645-8877.
Art Zany, radio for the imagination, with your host Paula Granquist, is brought to you by the Northfield Arts Guild and by the Paradise Center for the Arts. And now, Art Zany, radio for the imagination.
Good morning. This is Paula Granquist, and you're tuned in to Art Zany, Radio for the Imagination. Thank you so much for listening to the show that wakes up your imagination and helps you get ready to celebrate creating, and especially stories, because that is something that I think about a lot. And I wonder how you connect with your stories, because as I grow older, I think that what I remember or know about my past may not be how the rest of my family experienced this. And this has been really fascinating to discover this. And I bet it's happened to some of you too. You know, at a family gathering, you might ask, remember when? And somebody else says, well, that's not how I remember it. But you're like, you were in the same space, the same family, the same experience. It is so solid in my imagination. I can't believe you don't know. And it kind of boggles the mind that that can happen, because I think as a kid, I never really, maybe you don't revisit your memories as much, or maybe you don't rely on them as much, but there's something about things just happen. You know what they are. You don't question it. It just gets imprinted the way it does. And so it's really fascinating to have that question. And there's other times when you're with family or really forever friends when you hardly need the whole story, because you begin to remember or laugh or love because of a shared experience that only that group, you or whoever those people are, remember. It's like this cozy creation of our own making that we visit together in a way that's completely inaccessible to others. It's like this little private story that only you guys know, and nobody really has to say anything. And I love thinking about that. I love thinking about how our stories shape us, or how we connect with our stories, or maybe how we master our stories. I think it's a really intriguing area to explore. And so I love stories. You know that about me. I love reading, and I truly enjoy authors that help us explore our stories and our imaginations. So I'm very excited today to welcome author Kate Schwinn. And I hope I said that correctly. You know what, Kate? I meant to ask you ahead of time. That last name always gets me. Yeah?
Schwinn.
I did it.
It gets everybody. You got the first name right, so you get a lot of bonus points for that.
Schwinn. I will remember that now. Schwinn, like S. Wayne, right? Schwinn.
Yep.
Perfect. And yep. She is here to discuss her brand new novel. In fact, if you want it, you have got to put a pre-order on it right now. It's The Rending and the Nest. It goes on sale very, very soon. I guess I forgot to write down.
February 20th.
It's 20th, so it's mm-hmm. right around the corner, and it's called The Rending and the Nest, and it is a really amazing novel. I love how she's explored story in this, how she has set us up to think about things in the world, so we'll get into that in a little bit. But if you don't know Kate, she is a Northfield author. She teaches at St. Olaf College, and this is her first novel, but her third book. Her prior books, Tailings, a memoir, and a book of poetry called Tonka and Me, and she's a co-editor, I didn't know this, of Claiming Our Callings Toward a New Understanding of Vocation in the Liberal Arts, which is a great combination. Maybe we'll have a chance to visit about that. And you can find her poems and prose in journals such as Crazy Horse. Oh, no, they're going to do this to me. Pleiades. Mm-hmm. Oh, see, that Greek stuff just all those vowels.
I just try to get you.
Jubilat, Witness, Minnesota Review, and the anthology Fiction on a Stick, which is a great collection. It's a really amazing piece of work. I don't think it quite got as much attention as it should have. Mm-hmm. It's this anthology of Minnesota writers that is truly fascinating. She's a recipient of a Minnesota Book Award for Creative Nonfiction, a Minnesota State Arts Board grant, a Loft Mentor Winter Series Award, the Donald Justice Poetry Prize, and Best of the Net Anthology Award. So, and one of the things I think is most exciting is she's a winner of the Northfield Sidewalk Poetry Competition.
Yes.
Which is right now, if you're thinking you should be writing your poems for entering into that contest. Mm. You can learn more about her. Now, I'm going to give you the spelling because probably it's going to be a little bit Kaeta Schwain, mm-hmm. but it's K-A-E-T-H-E. So is that a German spelling? Mm-hmm. Okay. Yep. And then last name, S-C-H-W-E-H-N, which I don't know if that's German too. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
So, but you can find her, but just looking through the titles, The Rending and The Nest is the title of the book. We'll get into a little bit about what that is, but there's a really important party coming up that we want you to get on your calendar. That is on Thursday, February 22nd at 7 p.m. at Imminent Brewing, and nobody hosts a book launch like Imminent.
Mm-hmm.
We're very, really excited to have them in our community and to be able to have that space for those kinds of things. So the launch party is happening again on Thursday, February 22nd, so I bet you can pre-order it at the local bookstores too.
Mm-hmm.
So this is I'm so thrilled to have you here. First, I have to say
that I'm so thrilled to be here, Paula. Thank
and congratulations on this upcoming publication. And it's kind of exciting to visit with an author before the book is released. Mm-hmm. Also a little scary, you know. We want to for you, you know, the reviews are out, but mm-hmm. it's not been on the shelf in the bookstores. Mm-hmm. And I really hope that we can create some buzz. How are you feeling about that whole endeavor of having the novel published?
Oh, I mean, it's thrilling and exciting, and I feel exceptionally lucky. And I feel exceptionally lucky to be in a community like Northfield that is so embracing of books and arts, and I just can't think of a better place to launch a book from.
That's true, right. I mean, there are a lot of different parts of the community that love literature. And, you know, sometimes I worry that we're in a little bubble, mm-hmm. that we love books so much and that maybe that's not the rest of the world, but I don't know why it's not.
Just making our own little utopia.
But I think books are coming back. I think people are especially the actual paper books.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I don't think I ever converted to any sort of experience. And first, I want to thank you for giving me a new word, because I have to say the rending was not a word I knew, but mm-hmm. we should tell our listeners, because that's right in the first title, R-E-N-D-I-N-G, which other listeners may not know as well. Mm-hmm. And the book is The Rending and the Nest. The rending, where did that come mm-hmm. into the title? And tell us about the word.
Yeah, so the rending is the word that people use to the book is post-apocalyptic and begins about 4 years after the actual apocalyptic event takes place. And so the rending is the word that the people, at least in this novel, have come to use to describe that event. And it's a little bit in reference, and this is mentioned by the characters, the moment when Jesus died, and it talks about the curtain being torn or rent. So that there's a little bit of biblical allusion there in terms of rending, but mostly just the word, this tearing between the before, as the characters experienced it, and the present of the novel. And so the book is in many ways about the divides for the characters between who they were and who they're choosing to become.
And when I looked it up, the example that was given was when a tree is split by lightning.
Oh.
The sound that makes. And I thought,
really? I love that.
I did.
Oh, that makes it even better.
Exactly, right?
Yes,
and
thank
so
you.
I thought, well, I've never known that that
well,
had
I'm going to use that now, Paul.
You should. So yeah, it has a lot of layers and meanings, but it's definitely that split, mm-hmm. and that, which is a big part of the book, as he mentioned. And I don't want people to be scared, you know, when they hear post-apocalyptic.
Oh, right.
You know,
yes.
That, because that is something I never thought that I would read, but then I read Mendel.
Station 11.
Yes.
Yes.
And
mm-hmm.
which is like this book that just blew my mind.
Oh,
and
so gorgeous.
Exactly,
yes.
Right? And another story. So if you, it really could be, it just happens that that's the setting. It doesn't, but it doesn't mean that the story is not about more than just that.
Right.
Which is also true in your book. And you've really invented an original world. That is absolutely true. And I want to know how you began to play with this new world and created the rules and how you kind of stepped into and mastered this universe. What were the ways that you were able to decide how does this world work? Because that's the cool thing about creating a post-apocalyptic world is you get to decide.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of fun.
That's a great question. I mean, I don't know if it's true for you as you're creating, but for me, the whole joy of creating is not knowing or really deciding things in advance. So I would say when I'm writing, I'm just kind of watching the characters or following an image or something like that. So the process for me is not at all about I'm going to set up a whole little universe first and then see what happens inside it. It's really getting to see the characters walk around in it. And so actually this novel first started in Florida. Now it's in Minnesota.
Whole
right.
Another world.
Totally different world. And I think partly what I realized is that there's a lot of strange stuff that happens. And so if you're going to ask an audience to go along with those things, that I feel like the audience really needs to be grounded in the familiar in certain other ways, right? And so one way of doing that is setting it, for me, was setting it in Minnesota, where, it's Zion, which is the community, is pretty close to where Northfield is.
You can see traveling down Cedar Avenue. You know some of the things in it. That's cool, kind of an inside thing that those of us that live in this community will grasp.
Oh, yes, yes. So Northfielders will have the inside scoop on this book from the beginning. And there's scenes that take place in the Minnesota Zoo and Mall of America. So there's a lot of familiar stuff. So I think setting it in Minnesota for me was important because then the terrain was familiar, even as it was deeply strange at the same time. And similarly with the rules, the community makes a certain set of rules that they live by, but there's also certain things like, the weather hovers between sort of, around 55 to 60 degrees all the time, and the sky is perpetually gray.
I know, that made me really sad because I thought today the sun is shining in and it might be, making our eyes a little watery, but it's so awesome.
I can't imagine
a world.
Yes, and it takes its toll on them for sure. But those sorts of rules, I think when I was in graduate school and writing poetry, I was writing these pretty weird, surrealist-y kind of poems. And I had a teacher, a mentor, say, if you're going to give an audience a world like that in a poem, the audience has to feel like there's a set of rules by which this world is performing. And if we feel like literally anything could happen, it won't feel real enough to us to really enter. That makes any sense?
It does. So you have to have some sort of, is it a familiarity or a compassion or a connection?
Yeah, or a sense of grounding. A sense of that certain bizarre things might happen, but these other things are going to stay the same, right?
So then we can enter it and maybe coexist with it.
Yes, exactly. Gives the audience a place to enter.
Yeah, and I think that one of the things I read, you talked about this, the building of trust of your imagination. This was from some of the publicity notes. Mm-hmm. And the poets that you studied, you said, offered you permission to try making huge associative leaps and connections, and they made it seem like play was the heart of doing good work. I was drawn to that quote because I sometimes it's easy to forget about that play part when you're making something because you're working to try to make it make sense or force it into something. And those are the elements where the magic happens.
Yes.
And that must have been really true with creating a new world, needing to have that anything's possible.
Yep. And the novel was very much, in spite of the fact that at times the tone is pretty stark. I mean, there's some humor in here for sure. But it really was an act of play for me, and especially because I had never written a novel before, I didn't really have expectations for myself. And I think anytime, we're writing or creating and we can put ourselves in a place of not having our own expectations or the expectations of others looming over us in terms of what we're supposed to do or what would look nice or what would make other people happy, that's the time where we can really do good work.
I think that we should tell our listeners a little bit about the world that happens in this novel, The Rending and the Nest. And maybe you could start by telling us the main characters, Mira and Lana, are, how did they first come to you? Were they in the picture from early on?
Yes, definitely. So Mira's a pastor's kid, and Lana is a former, she was, when the rending occurred, about to set off on a dance scholarship in college. And they're very good friends and very different. And then when the novel opens 4 years after the rending, Lana has just figured out that she's pregnant. And this is going to be the first baby they know of that's going to be born since the rending.
Right. So it's been 4 years and every woman was infertile or unable, or
unclear, Paula, unclear.
But it is a big story.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
For them to be able to enter this and talk about the one of the in the early scenes, there's the piles that they go to, which I just found fascinating because it was both, you know, it reminded me of going to the junkyard with my dad, but it also reminded me of sort of, you know, you see the images on you know, news stories about people struggling to survive and they're picking through trying to find things to sell. And so I had both those feelings at the same time.
Yes. So one of the things that's happened after the rending is the characters sort of wake up. Everybody kind of passes out at the moment of the rending and they wake up. And there's these, like 95% of the objects are just gone, vanished, but have been sort of recreated into these huge piles that are kind of scattered across the landscape in various places. And so Mira, so this takes place 4 years after the rending. There's this community called Zion that Mira and Lana are a part of. And Mira's job in the community is to climb these piles in search of objects that the community might need. So she's very much into repurposing things. And later on in the book, she searches the piles to create these nests, and that's where the nest comes from in the title. So she starts to create out of these, you know, leftover items something beautiful and necessary for her community too.
Right. And I think that was, you know, she's, I think you mentioned she walks spider-like up these, and I'm, you know, so that you can imagine they're really tall and, you know, it is precarious if you want that tube inside the toaster and you have, like, if you yank that, does that drop and make the other thing, like, you think of a stack of oranges at a grocery store.
Yeah. We've all had that moment, right?
And so she's, very adept at that and very good at that's kind of, that becomes her job. Mm-hmm. And so you, in this world that they find themselves, they have to create a community and figure out, like, how do we take care of each other? Where do we sleep? What do we do? And so she brings these things back to the sorting. I can't remember what they call it.
Sorting stations.
Sorting stations. And then they try to, like, rebuild life.
Right. Yeah, the book is very much about Zion is one of the communities, but then there's also a very dysfunctional community that is present at the Minnesota Zoo, and then there's a third community later in the book, and each community is different and modeled differently and functions differently. So I think I was thinking a lot about how do we make communities and good communities happen in our lives.
Yeah, and did I was curious if the things in the pile, because they become very important and meaningful, but did that shape how, I guess I started thinking about the meaning of stuff in our life.
Yes.
You know, and kind of what do we really need and what do we miss and what do we have to have. And I found that fascinating how they explored, you know, the setting up of the clinic and each of them kind of taking on roles even though they didn't have experience. Did you think about that ahead of time that you wanted to make a statement about things in our world, or was that kind of
I mean, my big belief is that I think our our deepest held values are going to come out in what we write. But I think it's Denise Levertov who said you can't write a poem out of ought to. So I think if we approach writing from a place of, you know, wanting to be didactic and teach our readers a lesson, that becomes really dangerous. So I certainly in no way was wanting to teach a lesson about stuff.
No, and I don't think I got that, but it just kind of opened up this thought process.
Yes, exactly. Good. Yes.
Of like, well, oh, I guess what would I really miss? What would I really want? How would I deal with, you know, whatever's presented to me? So those were the things I was thinking about, and it's very organic to the story because that's the situation they're presented, right? And so it comes across, and it's really fascinating in this discovery of these, you know, people creating that community and then figuring out, oh, there's another community.
And it's not created quite like ours.
Exactly. And so, folks, if you're just tuning in, I am talking with Kata Schwain.
Yep.
I had to, like, look at my visualization there of how to pronounce that. And we're talking about the new book, The Rending and the Nest, on sale February 20th. So you have a few days to get your name on a list. Make sure you get your copy. Or you can come to the wonderful launch party, which is happening at Imminent Brewing in Northfield on Thursday, the 22nd, from 7 to 9. You're also touring, which is really exciting. I have to say, you're going next after our Northfield launch to one of my absolute favorite places on earth, Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City, Iowa.
I get to read with one of my dear, dear friends there.
Oh, and
I'll put out a shout out for her book, too. She's a poet, Kiki Petrosino, and she has a book out called Witch Wife.
Ooh, I love the title.
Yes, and her book of poems is very much about wrestling a little bit with whether she wants to become a mother or not. And so it'll be interesting because the Rending in the Nest becomes very much about motherhood, because the first birth, the women start giving birth to inanimate objects.
I was wondering if we should tell that. But
I'm telling it because it's all over. I mean, you know, it's in the
publicity
book
stuff.
Flap and the publicity stuff. So it's no longer a secret. So we wrestled with whether we should reveal that.
I think, because that is kind of a key component of what shifts things for them, and then them deciding, you know, do they want to get pregnant? Do they, what do they do with how should they value them?
Yep.
And what questions does that bring about what the future? And I mean, just a million things.
Yep.
And that's a fascinating part of it. So I'll have to check out. Maybe she'll come back up to Northfield. You can put in a plug.
Yes, I will.
That sounds fascinating. And you, I was thinking, you mentioned poetry and that your prior books were a book of poems and then a memoir.
Yeah.
Do you think that, part of what you are is an amazing writer, and that allows you to play in all those different spaces. Do you think that you could, that there was a reason that was the order that you wrote them, or that they kind of worked together to help build this world for you? I was thinking about the interrelationship between those books.
Well, there's definitely an interrelationship between the books. I think in terms of order, that poetry really gave me a lot of practice with image and with language. And the other thing poetry does is that with each poem, you have the permission to sort of create a new world on the page. And for some poets, there's a kind of interior world, I think, that gets recreated multiple times. But I was always really interested in persona poems, so speaking from the point of view of different random people. And so I think poetry did give me good practice with, okay, what is this little world going to be? All right, next page, what is this little world going to be? Whereas some of the feedback I got after writing lots of those poems where I was just wanting to be someone else all the time is sort of the question, where are you in all of this? I was very reluctant to put myself and maybe the I as close to who I am into those poems. And so two students at St. Olaf asked me to do an independent study on memoir writing. And I said, sure, and then realized I didn't know a lot about that. And I do feel like if you're going to try to teach it to students, you got to be in the trenches trying to do it yourself. So I wrote the memoir, and that gave me really good practice in having to connect with who I was. And there are many aspects of The Rending in the Nest that are actually very connected to the community that the memoir is about, Holden Village. And of course, all of it done subconsciously for the most part. But the characters, for instance, have community meetings in the book, which are in some ways similar to the community meetings I experienced living in this remote community. And in this remote community, there are these huge tailings piles that are left over from the mining days.
I didn't think about that. Okay.
And so, and at the top of those tailings piles, if you would, it's not there anymore, but I think it's been mostly cleared, but you could walk up and see all of this stuff left behind by the miners. So not exactly a pile of objects, right? But I did have the experience of climbing these piles and at the top seeing the kind of detritus of leftover lives. And thinking a lot, that community is very isolated in the winter. When I lived there, there was no email, there was no phone connection. 9/11 happened right when I first got up there. And so there was this sort of experience of feeling like this event that was sort of apocalyptic to the United States at the time, I think, was happening, and you were experiencing it in a very, very different way at Holden because we didn't have TVs. We weren't watching it in that
way.
Right,
and that was what most of us did, was turn to the visual.
Right, over and over, right? Didn't you spend the whole day watching it?
It happened and I was writing up and didn't know. And so it was a weird experience from that perspective because it was like 5 hours after it happened, my husband called and he's like, "How you doing?" I'm fine, you know.
you didn't know.
I didn't know, but then as course after you find out about it, you're like, I just can't stop consuming. Like, what is this about?
And
the whole world kind of went on this. I get a chill right now as we talk about it. This pause, which, you know, that feeling is played through in your book too, because they don't know. There's like the split. There's no explanation, and the world was one way. I think they call it before.
Yep.
And then they're creating what this is.
Yep.
And so I can see how each of those elements are woven in, and partly, you know, how your mastery of words and image and it comes through that you create this world in a really brilliant way, and it's a treat to read your words. So I'm excited for you, for listeners who are out there who are going to get a heads up on this book release. And I think the things that is explored in here include the, you know, faith and motherhood and community. And we haven't talked a lot about the aspect of either faith or motherhood. Yeah. And so I don't know which one of those you'd like to give us a little insight into.
Sure. So in terms of the faith piece, Mira's a pastor's kid, and she's like 17 when the rending happens. And it's just about at that moment where she's finding it very hard to believe in God, and seeing the sort of church situation she finds herself in every Sunday to be kind of false in certain ways. And then the rending happens, and she just kind of loses her sense of faith altogether. And what I realized after writing the book is I think that in some ways the book is about... I should say, she doesn't tell people after the rending that her dad was a pastor. She doesn't reveal that part of herself. And that becomes a question in the book. Like, if you had a do-over, are there parts of yourself that you would just excise and, you know, not mention to anyone ever again? Which some people have the opportunity to do in their actual lives in the world. But many of us, you know, it's kind of hard to entirely shake off the past, right?
But the readers do know, because there's the stories that get told to us through flashback of what her life was.
Yes.
So that's, I think, a really nice way to keep us in the know.
Right. So we know. But I think it becomes very clear once these women start giving birth to these inanimate objects, they it's hard for them to be near the objects, and it's hard for them to be away from the objects. They have this weird hold on them. And so Mira starts building these nests to hold the objects. And I think in terms of Faith, part of what's going on in the novel is she's wrestling with what parts of faith, of religion, of Christianity for her, in her case, might we need in our lives in order to make sense of that which we can't explain. Mm. And that if we don't have rituals or nests in this case, or prayers or whatever it is, that sometimes those things that we can't explain can be manipulated by others, and others can take hold of that story in ways that can harm us, which is partly what happens in the novel. So for me, ultimately, Mira starts to come to terms with what faith and what Christianity really was maybe to her father, and what it might be for her. So that's that part. And the motherhood part, I think I just was talking about the weird relationship the women have with these objects. Mm-hmm. That's really painful. And again, this wasn't something that was in any way intentional while I was writing. When I got to the end and started thinking more about the book, I had two very, very dear friends who experienced miscarriages and stillbirths while I was writing this, and watching the way in which their grief was compounded by the fact that as a society we don't have a way, or we don't have good ways to recognize those losses, that really fed into this story, I think, in certain ways. Because I think those losses felt so inexplicable and terrible, and what did you do, you know, what do you do with those, those memories, you know?
That one really hits me because of the fact that you're right. I mean, there's a little bit of shame with that, and there's a little bit of silence that happens. And so, you know, your family members may not even know that you experienced this. And there's not a way to appropriately be able to mourn that in a public way. Yep. So it becomes a very private endeavor. And so I found that to be a fascinating element that was, I don't think it's part of the story. But the fact that you tackled it and, you know, created these beautiful nests in the story to honor those objects kind of really is extraordinary. I expect it will create some great conversations.
Well, that would be wonderful. I'm so grateful to people who are willing to share, you know, stories and to be vulnerable and to let others witness what's going on, because I think it's such a gift, and I'm incredibly grateful to have friends who are willing to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so that's just another element in the story, and you know how we create these connections in our lives as a part of it as well. Do you want to read for a few minutes? Mm. Would that be something that since people can't go to the bookstore and pick up the book, not quite yet, but February 20th will come in a blink.
Yes. maybe should I just read? I could read the little prologue. Would that be?
That would be great. Yeah, okay. That's a fascinating piece.
Okay. The most dangerous thing of all is the absence of a story, a narrative to explain what is happening to you, a why with no edges, because someone will always arrive to invent one. Then you will be at the whim of someone else's story. You will be swept into a current that is not of your own making. It wasn't fire or ice, wasn't a virus or global warming or a meteor, wasn't an atomic bomb or a tsunami or a sulfurous-smelling ape. It was a rending, a split. 95% of the Earth's population and the vast majority of the animals, food, and goods gone. We were left with each other and the piles. Later, the babies. and we were left without an explanation.
Ooh, that is a reason to turn the page. Because it does, it tells us about that, the meaning of story in there, and the fact that I think humans just ache to create a story.
Yes.
And to make sense, and to, you know, have a common part of that story.
Yep.
And then this happens.
Right, right. Just like what you were saying at the beginning about telling stories, right? And that I think a big part of the book is about how, you know, we do have some control over the way we shape our own stories. Mm. And the way we choose to tell the stories of our life can have a great effect on who we become, actually.
And that's something that I don't think you recognize until later. Mm-hmm. You know, because you can see the same incident or type of incident can happen to two different people, but they become different because
yes.
of how they perceived it, or how they judge it, or how they manipulate it to, you know, manifest something else in their life. And
yeah.
it's really, it's a fascinating piece
yes.
of the story world.
There's like narrative psychologists actually do
Oh, this
work.
Is something.
Oh,
I
yeah,
have.
This is a thing. There's a guy named Dan McAdams, who I've read a little bit. He's a narrative psychologist and has done research on, well, he talks about generative adults, people who are really exuberant members of their community outside of their own family. And he did a bunch of research where he asked them to tell them all to tell the stories of their lives. And he found a similar pattern in terms of how they told their stories, like that things were bad. And then I had this moment of revelation. I mean, there's this entire
pattern.
Right?
Okay.
And there's other research that's been done that like on refugees, where if you ask them to tell their story, those refugees that talk about what their lives were like before, right, as connected to how they are in the new place, and they see the threads that connect it, actually are more successful and happier. Whereas people that see it as this schism, like things were this way and now they're this way, have a lot more trouble and are often a lot more depressed. So this idea that like two people could have the same things happen to them, but make different choices about how they're going to tell that story, right? And so that we don't get to control the events that happen to us, right? But we do have some control over this. And who are the people? And, you know, for some people, it's religion that helps shape that story, right? That gives us a parallel. And for some people, it's communities or friendships that help us learn to tell a story about ourselves that's going to be, you know, redemptive and full of life rather than death, you know?
Wow. I had no idea that this I got to go seek this
yeah.
out, because I think that's, I've always believed in the value of stories and always loved and been fascinated by,
yeah.
you know, how they, how people tell it, what details you omit, what you put in, how writers make decisions, how all of those pieces play. And so now there's something called a narrative psychologist out
yep.
there who's taking a look at that. And that sounds like there's potential for us to think about our immigrant populations and maybe, you know, be help boost their experiences mm-hmm. by helping them make the connections mm-hmm. as opposed mm-hmm. to, you know, I think about just last night at my mom, at her birthday dinner, we were talking about her parents who came from Norway
oh.
and that they kept speaking Norwegian but never taught the kids, so that they could have a secret language and, you know, just talk about things without the kids knowing, and that they never talked about the old world or the old country.
Interesting.
They created that boundary and that
yeah.
line. I bet there's a lot of other stories in mm-hmm. in America, especially,
Absolutely.
Where we cut that line.
Yep.
And so fascinating.
Yeah.
I love books like this that bring out these kinds of elements that make you think, oh, I wonder, or
mm-hmm.
I wouldn't do that choice that character made, or look what she did and how she made sense. And oh, it's so brilliant. So folks, you've got to get a hold of The Rending and the Nest. You have said one thing that in, I think it was your bio, that I think writing belongs in the messy middle of our lives,
mm-hmm.
making us stranger and stronger mm-hmm. word by word. And so you have clearly always had a value on mm-hmm. putting words to the page. Where does that mm-hmm. come from?
Oh, well, my parents for sure, right? Books were always a huge deal in our house, and my mom is actually a writer herself. She has an amazing YA book out called City of Cannibals.
Intriguing title.
Yes, very intriguing. Yes. Henry VIII, England. Yes. YA historical. That's great. So there was a lot of stories and reading going on. And I've just always, I think it's an amazing escape. I have a 8-year-old daughter, and in the last couple of years, watching her discover reading has been such an amazing joy, you know? I tried to talk to her yesterday afternoon, and she was like, "Mom, go away. I'm in the middle of a proposal here." Because there was something going on in the book that she didn't want me to, like, disturb. She was at that part of it.
Oh, I hear in my brain went, is she writing a proposal
book? Well, I said, I was like, wait, the 13-year-old is getting married? And she was like, no, the mom. And I was like, okay. You don't have to take that book away. So it just, you know, it's always been present there.
And so our blessings, and we are going to be celebrating in Northfield on the 22nd at Imminent Brewing. That starts at 7 p.m., so get that on your calendars now. Music by Queen Anne.
Yes.
Tell us, because I've heard them around town. But
yes, they are so fun, such a blast. They just bring such good energy and are these amazingly talented musicians as well. So I could not be more thrilled. I think it's going to be fabulous, and everyone is welcome, so please feel free to bring a friend. There's no, it's great if you want to buy a book, but this is really about, for me, it's about getting to say thank you to this community. I don't think a book is born on its own, you know. Writers get so much support from others, and so there's people in the community that have written blurbs for the book and taking the pictures for the back of the book and asked how the book was doing and just done so many amazing things. So please come to Imminent so I can say thank you to you.
Oh, that's so sweet. And I love your acknowledgments, because you do mention a certain bakery in town.
I do.
And I think that's something that I've always admired about you, is that, you know, you're always hard at work down in that little space. I'll let people find out for themselves. But you know, you've always had that commitment to writing, and just really set a good example for other authors in the community. And I think that, you know, this opportunity to have the launch party here brings our community together, which is a lovely thing about, you know, we get to create our community, even if we're not post-apocalyptic.
Yeah, right.
let's skip that part.
Yeah, my sister is due to have a baby in like 3 weeks. And so I was like, well, I mean, you could come to the launch party and, you know, give birth. That would be a super appropriate thing
that would be memorable.
It would be memorable, right?
Yeah, very memorable. Mm-hmm. And then you're going out on tour. So people, if they miss this event, can see you in a number of other places. I would recommend driving to Iowa City if you can. That would be an incredible thing. That's Friday, February 23rd. But you're also up in the Twin Cities, Black Dog Cafe on the 27th.
With Patrick Nathan, whose book Some Hell was just reviewed in the New York Times today. It's beautiful.
Oh, what great. Not many books get reviewed in that piece. So that's, and his book is fiction?
Fiction, yes. Out with Grey Wolf.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and a Grey Wolf. We, an incredible publisher in this community. Again, another reason our community is so incredible is the literary Twin Cities that happens. And you're doing the Fireside Reading Series up at Hamlin.
Yes.
And that's on the 28th.
Very thrilled to do that. Yep.
And then a book signing at AWP. My goodness. It's the Associated Writing Programs. Writers
and writing programs.
If you're not in the book world and literary world, it's sort of like the Super Bowl of writing, right?
It is. It's crazy.
It's fields and fields of authors and writers, and yes. I can remember being there and like being in the elevator with, you know, people that you just, you know, you're like, I can't believe that I'm standing in the elevator with this writer. So it's that's an incredible experience too. And so there's lots of buzz and lots of talk, and I hope we can create some more for you.
I'm so grateful to you for having me on, Paula. This is just fantastic.
Absolutely. The Rending and the Nest is the name of the book, and I highly encourage you to check that out. Get that out into the world, and then maybe we'll have a chance to have a visit again when more people have had a chance to read, and we can delve into all the details.
I would love that.
That'll be great. Thank you for joining me today.
Thanks so much.
Kata Swain.
Schwain.
Oh, darn it.
It's all good.
I just got so worried about the ending, I forgot about the beginning. Yeah, exciting.
Perfect.
Folks, this is Art Zany Radio for the Imagination. I've had a thrill today to be able to have Kata here, and I hope that you do definitely check out this book. I've got a couple things happening on my Art Happy List I want to mention. Last week, I had the fabulous Brendan Etter and Sherry Setchell here, and we were talking about Hedwig and the Angry Inch, and that opens up on Thursday, February 15th at 7:30. So I want you to get your tickets now. You can go to northfieldartsguild.org. They run for 2 weekends. Every show is in the evening because this is definitely a mature audience's event. It is at 7:30 on Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and then the second weekend, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, ending on the 24th. So there are no Sunday shows for this, no matinee. But it runs for only those 6 shows. You can get information at northfieldartsguild.org. I think that's a pretty phenomenal thing. And actually, I might bring you back on the mic because I want to talk about sidewalk poetry. Because now is the time that you should be submitting your sidewalk poems. I guess I forgot to print off the date of when those are due, but I bet it's... the kickoff was just on January 27th, so I think you have a couple of weeks to be able to do that. What advice would you give for somebody who's thinking about submitting to sidewalk poetry?
I mean, mostly my advice is submit.
You know, actually, you cannot play in the game unless you
have. Yeah, that's right. Do it. There's something so special about having your words in a sidewalk square. It's awesome, and it is what has lent me the greatest credibility to my children.
Oh, because they can walk by and say that.
They can walk by.
Otherwise.
Actually, you're like, oh, that's cool.
You are a writer.
Yeah, you are a writer, Mom. It looks like. Maybe you're legitimate.
That's phenomenal. So I hope people do participate in that. Folks, you have been listening to Art Zany. I am so pleased. And I hope that you add some of that Art Zany to your life this week. And in the meantime, until next time, enjoy your imagination.
You've been listening to Art Zany, Radio for the Imagination, with your host, Paula Granquist. Art Zany is brought to you each week by the Northfield Arts Guild and by the Paradise Center for the Arts in Faribault. Saturday, February 10th, the Paradise Center for the Arts presents Minnesota legend Martin Zeller and his band, The Hard Ways. Join us as Minnesota's favorite singer-songwriter returns to the Paradise for one night only, featuring original songs and classic covers. Martin Zeller and the Hard Ways, Saturday, February 10th, 7:30 at the Paradise Center for the Arts in Faribault. For information and tickets, visit paradisecenterforthearts.org.